left my little home in Illinois while whistling a traveling tune.
Welcome to Curiosity in the Corn from WNIJ, Northern Public Radio,
where we uncover the unexplored oddities, neglected anomalies, and little-known history of our region.
I'm Connie Kuntz, an all-around curious person who loves uncovering the interesting and unique people, places, and events that are all around us.
And I'm Clint Cargow, a writer and historian who wants to know, what sparks your curiosity?
If you have a question you'd like us to answer,
or a topic you'd like us to explore,
visit us at WNIJ.org and click Curiosity in the Corn. Hi, Clint.
Hi, Connie. What do you have for me this week?
I have a clip for you, and I want you to try and guess what language this is.
Dod in ol at vengoid.
Sounds Gaelic? Can I hear it again?
Dod in ol at vengoid.
Irish, maybe.
Close. It's Welsh.
Welsh? That wouldn't even have occurred to me. Do you have a translation?
There's not a direct translation to English. Literally, it means to return to my trees. But the basic meaning is to relax and unwind. You know, collect your thoughts after a busy day at work.
Return to my trees. I like that. And I'm curious now because it seems like this episode is going to be about the Welsh. And I'll just go ahead and admit it. I don't know anything about Wales.
You've certainly heard of some famous Welsh people.
Okay, well, I know that Diana was the Princess of Wales, and I guess the Queen got all her corgis from Wales.
Sir Anthony Hopkins is Welsh. Catherine Zeta-Jones, Richard Burton was Welsh, the poet Dylan Thomas.
Oh, of course, A Child's Christmas in Wales.
And I'll bet you didn't know that Tom Jones was Welsh.
No. Tom Jones is Welsh?
Here he is, being asked about it back in 1987.
But, you know, do they understand you? I mean, do they understand you because you are Welsh? You are very Welsh, still very Welsh. And perhaps they don't even know Wales exists in America, do they?
Well, they know it exists, they've heard of it, but they don't know exactly where it is. The majority of people. I have to sort of give them a bit of a geography lesson.
How have you kept your accent so much?
Because of the Welsh people that are around me. My wife is Welsh, my mother and sister live with us in...
So not only can the Welsh claim Tom Jones, but they've got, like, the coolest flag I've ever seen. Check this out.
Oh, wow. Okay, this is cool. Just looking at this here, the top half is white, the bottom half is green, and the whole thing is covered by a giant red scaly dragon who has, like, sharp claws and a pointy tongue shooting out of its mouth.
The colors symbolize the Tudor kings and queens who ruled England. The red dragon, the earliest use of which can be traced back 1,500 years, was supposedly on the battle flag of King Arthur. And it isn't the only dragon significant to Welsh mythology. There's also a white dragon.
The red dragon always symbolized the Briton. The white dragon symbolized the Saxons. The battles that they would fight in mythology would often mirror real-life battles going on at the time for control over the territory.
That's Gwen, a political science major at Northern Illinois University. She started studying Welsh culture when she was in middle school. She even taught herself how to speak Welsh. That was her at the beginning of the episode.
There's a myth where Merlin prophesizes that the white dragon would be successful at first in their many wars, but the red dragon would eventually triumph and regain the area of England.
So it's a good mix of history and mythology.
With an awesome dragon on top. So I was curious how Gwen, Illinois native, got so interested in Wales in the first place.
You hear about England and Scotland and Ireland, but it just seems like, you know, Wales is kind of overlooked. And so I just started to research more and more into it. And I just discovered that there's this nation that's just so full of poetry and song, and they have their own language. There's just this beautiful language. And the more words I learned, I really did just fall in love with the language.
Gwen says she hopes people will continue to explore little-known languages because it keeps them from dying out and also teaches you more about the culture.
I'd love to hear some more.
Sure.
Cenedl heb iaith, cenedl heb galon, which means a nation without a language is a nation without a heart.
Beautiful. But I've got to ask, Connie, what does any of this have to do with Northern Illinois?
Right. So the Welsh actually have a little-known connection to our neck of the woods. It's sort of a lost history, but I think first we need some background on how the Welsh got here in the first place, because this region has a rich immigrant history.
And if we're talking early 19th century, then every white settler in the Midwest is an immigrant, right?
Right, and by 1850, about 3/4 of those settlers were born in the United States somewhere back east, which means the other fourth emigrated directly from Europe, and several groups came in waves, which is why towns across northern Illinois had large populations that were German, Irish, Scottish, Swedish, Norwegian, Polish, Finnish. And in community after community, their contributions are well documented. But the Welsh, we know next to nothing about. The Welsh began emigrating to North America as early as the 17th century, settling mostly in New York and Pennsylvania. Some came to escape religious persecution, some came for job opportunities, and most of them were farmers. But the big Welsh migration took place in the early 19th century, when the nation suffered a big depression coupled with poor harvests, which eventually led to several riots. In 1840, a Welshman named Edward Jones published a book titled The American Traveler, or Advice to Emigrants from Wales to America. At the same time, Wales was also going through an industrial revolution similar to the one in the States, so you saw a lot of skilled Welsh miners, quarrymen, and iron workers emigrating here. They tended to stay on the more industrialized East Coast, while the Welsh farmers tended to migrate west, bouncing from Welsh community to Welsh community in search of new land and opportunities.
And eventually some of these immigrants made their way here.
Yes, they moved from Pennsylvania to Ohio to Indiana and eventually to here. So the town that drew my initial interest was Big Rock, Illinois, nestled in the cornfields of southwestern Kane County. The book The Past and Present of Kane County, Illinois, published in 1878, contains the following passage about the Cymry, which is what the Welsh call themselves.
The land of the Druids, Wales, sent a colony of the Cymry into Big Rock, the pioneers of whom were John Pierce from South Wales and Edward Wilden and Maurice Pierce from North Wales, the first named coming in the spring of 1836 and the latter during the same year, and the settlement of the town by the Welsh is due more to them than anyone else.
The book goes on to list several other Welsh immigrants who joined their companions at Big Rock in the 1830s and 1840s. It even refers to the place specifically as a Welsh colony, and then lists even more families that were known to be, and I quote, from the land of the leek.
Land of the leek?
Like the onion kind of leek? It's another national symbol of Wales that goes back centuries. Like the Red Dragon, its origin story is steeped in myth.
So what did these Welsh settlers do?
They farmed. They were almost all farmers. That 1878 history book has biographical information on hundreds of residents in the area, and everyone who came from Wales is listed as a farmer except for one blacksmith and one man who is listed as both a carpenter and a farmer. So the Welsh, who had experience as coal miners and quarrymen, seemed to disperse to various locations around the state wherever work was available, but they didn't seem to form large Welsh communities. The Welsh farmers in Big Rock stuck together. So I drove down to Big Rock to check it out.
And?
Well, there's not a lot there. I mean, it's a nice little town, but if you're looking for anything that screams Welsh or anything that even whispers Welsh, then you will be out of luck. There is a cemetery called the Big Rock Welsh Cemetery, where several of the early Welsh settlers are buried. Some of the gravestones have Welsh writing. I've got some pictures that I'll put up on our website. But then I headed over to the Big Rock Historical Society. Now, the Historical Society Museum is a cool place. It sits on a 3-acre property, most of it farmland. The museum is located inside an old converted corn crib. It's got two floors, packed to the beams with Big Rock history and memorabilia, everything from antique plows to military uniforms to an old schoolroom. I met the Society's director, Sue Beck, and Big Rock resident June Thomas.
My family goes way back to Wales, and some of them came here one at a time from the family, and most of them seemed to want farmland.
That's June. And by the way, she is 93 years old.
Many of the farms were very narrow. They did that because they wanted frontage on the road. They wanted a creek, and they wanted timber all on their own farm so that they were self-sufficient.
And Big Rock provided all of those things. So June's grandmother emigrated from Wales, but as June mentioned, they didn't all come at once. Her grandmother's older brother came first.
And then he provided through the years for all of the 11 brothers and sisters to come to America also.
June's family came from different areas of Wales. Her grandfather came from North Wales. Her husband's family came from South Wales. His great-grandfather, William Thomas, wrote an account of his journey to America. He describes leaving South Wales in 1851 at age 18, then sailing 6 weeks to Quebec. He works various farm jobs in the general area of Toronto when he writes, "I got a letter from home that my Uncle John was in Chicago. There was much talk of the Great Prairies of Illinois. I was anxious to see them." He took a boat from Buffalo to Chicago, where he found work as a carpenter. He eventually married a Welsh woman from Big Rock, and they settled there amongst the other Welsh families.
Was that a pretty typical way that many Welsh immigrants arrived in Big Rock?
I think it was just one way, a more roundabout way. Every immigrant's story is unique, but I wanted to share that as an example of how this one Welsh immigrant arrived in Illinois, and his descendants still live there today.
Any traditions? Welsh food?
Well, when June was little, her grandparents would take her to visit Welsh relatives in Chicago.
This one aunt, she always, as a treat, she served us like a lamb with mint jelly. It had to have mint jelly. And my grandmother made individual little mince pies for holidays. They made plum puddings and fruitcake. Yeah, any of those kind of things are what I remember as being served in a Welsh atmosphere.
So what about the language? Is there anyone in Big Rock who actually speaks Welsh or can translate Welsh?
I asked that, and there's not. But here's something I found really interesting. June has a cousin who moved from Big Rock to London. She's dating a man from Wales who speaks Welsh, so when she comes back to Big Rock to visit, he'll come along and translate any Welsh documents or inscriptions that the Historical Society may have run across since his last visit.
So the Welsh descendants from Big Rock are far enough removed from their ancestry that they have to import a translator from Wales.
Yep. But I did ask if there was anything at all in Big Rock that could be traced back to its Welsh ancestry, and June had an immediate response.
The Big Rock plowing match.
Plowing match.
Held annually in Big Rock. In fact, this September will be the 125th Big Rock Plowing Match.
That was started because my husband's great-grandma was a go-getter, and she said, we've had these plowing matches in Wales, and we need one in Big Rock.
So the plowing match is rooted in Welsh tradition. It was June's husband's Welsh ancestors who held the first Big Rock plowing match right in their front yard.
It sounds like they created a contest where their neighbors competed to plow their field for them.
Very clever, those Welsh.
Is the winner, like, whoever plows the fastest?
Actually, it's all about quality. Who cuts the best-looking furrow?
I'm a sucker for a good-looking furrow.
But June did mention that back in Wales, these competitions started more as social events. A way to get together with your neighbor, but also get some work done.
Okay, like an old-fashioned barn raising. So what goes on at a plowing match?
It's grown into a big country fair. There are a lot of antique tractors, a horse show, arts and crafts show, live music. There's even a contest where teams race to push a 1,200-pound bale of straw across a finish line. And of course, tons of food. It's also one of the only plowing competitions left in the country.
I'd say that's a pretty impressive Welsh legacy for this region. I'd also say this event qualifies as a Northern Illinois curiosity.
You think we should go? Do a follow-up to this episode?
Definitely. The Welsh plowed the way. What were the dates again?
September 13 through 15.
All right. And maybe some of our listeners out there have more information about Welsh immigrants in Northern Illinois. Some traditions? Some artifacts?
There are at least 3 Welsh heritage societies in Chicago, but I don't know beyond that. I'd like to know what else is out there in our listening area.
Reach out to us at corn@niu.edu and tell us your story.
Excuse me, guys. Did I overhear you guys talking about the Welsh?
Yes, you did, WNIJ reporter Peter Medlin.
Well, that reminds me of a story, actually. Because, you know, my family is Welsh, or at least my dad's side of my family is Welsh. And it's not even as if, like, they recently immigrated over there. Like, we've been in America for a very long time. But I don't even remember how this conversation got started or who first told me about the Welsh heritage, but there's really like only a few of like the last vestiges of like my dad's side of our family's kind of shared ancestry that we hold on to. And like I said, I don't know if this was my dad or my grandma would tell me this when I was a kid, but it was always on St. Patrick's Day they would tell us to wear orange, which for an 8-year-old who is surrounded by an entire school of kids wearing green, for me to say, you should definitely wear orange, especially on a holiday that's somewhat predicated upon being pinched for not wearing that color, it took me a minute, but I was like, okay, I guess for the ancestry, I will take this one for the team. And so it was kind of just like a fun thing to do and to explain to people and be like, hey, I'm not just doing this because I'm being irritating. There is a historical reason for me being irritating on this holiday.
Do you know why you had to wear orange instead of green?
So I had to look this up later on. It was something that I just took as read for years and years and years. And it wasn't until you brought this up to me that I actually did any sort of research. And from what I found out is that, you know, if you look at the Irish flag, it's green on the left side. It is orange on the right side, and it's white in the middle. And the green side is supposed to represent Catholicism, and the orange is supposed to represent Protestantism, and the white is the unity between those two things. So I suppose that orange was, you know, represent, so like Protestants would wear orange on that too. I don't know if it was for protest of something or just representation reasons. But that's why we did it. And so that's why my family told me to do that as well. But I also just remember growing up, the Welsh flag being a thing where, like, you know, once we kind of figured out that, like, oh, you know, wear orange because of your Welsh heritage, you'd be like, well, what else is Welsh? And I remember my brother having this big Welsh flag in his room. So they were kind of around our house a little bit. And it's, if you've ever seen the Welsh flag, and I don't know if you guys describe it in this episode, it's the sickest flag of all the flags. Everyone should have it up. It's the best.
Now I'm going to be on the lookout for people wearing orange on St. Patrick's Day. All right. Thanks for sharing your Welsh heritage with us, Peter.
Oh, of course. Anytime.
And thank you, Connie, for digging up all that Welsh history.
Thank you, Clint.
And again, if you have some Welsh heritage or some interesting Welsh traditions you'd like to share with us, maybe you had to wear orange on St. Patrick's Day. Tell us about it at corn@niu.edu. And if you're interested in visiting the Big Rock Historical Society Museum, go to bigrockhistoricalsociety.org to check their hours and location. And for more about the 125th Annual Big Rock Plowing Match, visit bigrockplowingmatch.com.
And if you know something unique to the Northern Illinois region, a person, a place, or an event, anything our listeners will be curious about, just go to our website, wnij.org, click the Curiosity in the Corn logo on the right side of the screen, and tell us what it is.
This program was produced by WNIJ, where you learn something new every day.
A special thanks to Sue Beck and June Thomas of the Big Rock Historical Society, and thanks to the show's intern, Nick Kowalczyk, who came up with the story for this episode and conducted the interviews. Spencer Tritt handled the sound, and special thanks to Guy Stevens.
Our theme song was provided by Dan Whitaker and the Shinebenders. You can check out their music and other music from regional and touring bands at another WNIJ show, Sessions from Studio A.
We'll drop a link in the show notes, which you can find at wnij.org. I'm Connie Kuntz.
And I'm Clint Cargow. Thanks for listening.